You're listening to The Space Show with Andrew Rennie. This evening we bring you the third in what we have extended out to five programs devoted to the International Space Station. Program 1 gave first a broad oversight of the space station. Program 2 was a celebration of the first 10 years of human occupation of what has grown to be the largest structure ever assembled in space. It also highlighted the international cooperation involved. Now, Program 3, this one, will take stock of the current status of the station and bring to your attention some of the exciting developments that will happen later this year. Program 4 is both a look back at the first 10 years of space operations and a peek forward to the future of mankind's orbital outpost, including plans for commercial crews. Program 5 will bring you an audio feature entitled 10 Years and Counting. Now, as with the others in this series, we begin with the Beatles tribute band Love and Mersey performing Back in the ISS. Yes, that's right, ISS, not the USSR. So here we go with the tribute band.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, top.
Music and lyrics by Jan Hovers. That was the Beatles tribute band Love and Mersey. Well, the International Space Station is the largest structure ever assembled in space. It is as big as a football pitch and has now been continuously inhabited for more than 10 years. The first elements of the International Space Station were lofted into orbit some 400 kilometres above the Earth in 1998. It is now essentially complete, although some modules will be added. As big as a football field, as I've just said, the station circles the Earth 16 times a day with a six-person crew. These are Russians, United States Americans, Canadians, Japanese, and Europeans. Each spends up to 6 months aboard before returning to Earth. A few weeks ago, NASA hosted a media conference at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. This evening, we bring you that briefing, including responses to reporters' questions. First to the microphone was Mike Saffredini, the Space Station Program Manager. He gave a status report on the station.
There are a number of things that have to occur on orbit in sequence for things to work. And it's not just about crew rotations, it's also about the logistics on board and then doing all the work that we need to do on board in between the arrival and departures of vehicles. So the crew on orbit today is, in the last few weeks actually, has been averaging on the order of about 50 hours a week, and this was our effort to catch back up with the crew time necessary to meet our requirement for the research community of 35 hours a week dedicated to research. And so we're well on track to reach that average in spite of the progress anomaly that happened earlier or about the middle of last year. It's hard. Things are all going together for us. And so that's we're well on our way to catch back up. That was our plan at the end of this increment to be there, and I think hours-wise we'll be in good shape. So we're proceeding along well on orbit. We've had a couple of minor anomalies along the way. One of them, perhaps not so minor, but not causing us any problem on board today, is a main bus switching unit, MBSU. It's one of four very large power systems on board the ISS that distribute all the power from the solar arrays to all the systems on board ISS. MBSU-1 has had a little trouble because of some radiation hits that were taken on its memory unit that it wasn't able to reset itself. And so in this particular condition now, the box has gotten to the point where it won't communicate with us, but it's still passing on power, and we have all the protections we require from it. So we've left it to operate alone, and it seems to be doing the function that's required. So assuming it doesn't fail in a manner that causes it not to provide power any longer, which we're not expecting, we are looking to replace that box in the late summer, early fall time frame, and I'll touch on that in just a minute as we go down the sequence of events. So that's probably the main one we've been working on. A little anomalies have occurred here and there. You've seen that the water processor was down for a little while. We had to replace a catalytic reactor in that unit. It's back up and running now. We've had a little hiccup with the one of the beta gimbals, the 2A beta gimbal, that we've recovered as well. It had some comm problems as well, which we think might be related to some FOD inside the beta gimbal unit itself, and so we'll be watching that closely. But that's also since we have backup command capability or communication capability with that gimbal, we're in good shape.
Space Station Program Manager Mike Saffredini. Mike then moved on to outline the events planned for late March and the coming months. He was speaking several weeks ago, just before the European Space Agency's cargo spacecraft ATV-3 was launched. Since then, the ATV has actually docked with the space station and is currently there.
So with that, I thought I'd take a minute and talk about the vehicles that are about to come to ISS, and then I'll pass it on to the rest of the folks to tell you what's going on orbit. The next flight in sequence is ATV-3, which is in Kourou getting ready to launch here on the 23rd, so at the end of this week. There was a delay. It was originally scheduled to launch on the 9th. We were looking at some closeout photos. Unfortunately, after the shroud had already been put over the ATV, and we found that some of the buckles were loose and didn't have the secondary locking feature installed. And so the decision was made to go ahead and go back in and snug up those straps and also put in the secondary locking feature. And then the spacecraft was buttoned back up and is on track to launch on time on the 23rd. We have dealt with a couple issues having to do with elevated levels of bacteria count in both on some of the surfaces of the bag and in the air. We have ways to deal with that. And in fact, in the case of the surface area on the bags, we have a higher constraint on the ground pre-launch than we actually have
for the on-orbit requirement, and we meet the on-orbit requirement. So you can see that this is a level that we want to take a look at and think about and react to, but it's not really a constraint to launch. And so we'll process the paper for both of those concerns and be ready for the launch on the 23rd. And it docks on the 28th of March. Following that, then, we have a progress that's coming up. 47 Progress will come up, launches on the 20th of April. Subsequent to that, then, is, or following that, is two things occur on the 30th of April. One is we have the return of the crew. Antonio, Anton, and Dan come home on the 30th of April. And also on that date today, currently scheduled, is the first launch of the SpaceX demo mission to ISS, which will plan to do its demo around ISS on the 2nd of May and be birthed on the 3rd of May. So that's in the plan. And then following that event, the next crew comes up. Gennady, Sergey, and Joe come up on the 15th of May and dock to the ISS on the 17th of May. Then later in the summer, although it's not been officially announced, we have a planning date to launch an HTV about the 21st of July. We're still finalizing that date, but that's the planning date we're using. And then we'll get it docked. There's a possibility we'll have a commercial launch in the August timeframe. It's possible that SpaceX One could arrive then, so we're protecting that alternative. But then the demo flight for the orbital spacecraft will be occurring, launching on the September 1st and docking, berthing, on the 6th of September. So let's go back to the August launch. So if the if SpaceX One is ready to launch, we'll move the HTV to the Zenith port and be prepared to bring the SpaceX vehicle up and berth it to the Nader port and have two spacecraft up at the same time. If the SpaceX One flight does not occur in August, and from a logistics standpoint, that's not really a concern. We're in very good shape on orbit for logistics, so if it slips a little bit, that's okay. Then we'll probably, you'll see us go ahead and put that EVA to replace the main bus switching unit at that time. So now that's a whole lot of work that the crew has to do the berthings and the dockings and the EVAs. And in the middle of all that, we've made a commitment to the research community that we would obligate 35 hours on average a week for research, and we intend to meet that honor while doing all this work that I just told you about.
That was International Space Station Program Manager talking with reporters at the Johnson Space Center. That's Mike Saffredini. Dina Contella is the Expedition 32 and 33 Lead Flight Director. Now, the crews on the station have been numbered sequentially since Expedition 1 in 2000. Currently, Expedition 30 is living aboard the space station. The expeditions often overlap, which can make their numbering a little confusing. Here is what Dina had to say about the planned activities of Expeditions 32 and 33.
So with that, I thought I'd take a minute and talk about the vehicles that are about to come to ISS, and then I'll pass
well,
it on
obviously
to
I've done the, wrong
the
one
rest
there.
Of the folks to tell you what's going on in orbit.
Well, something's gone wrong here. I'm not quite sure what's gone here.
The vehicles that are about to come to ISS.
Well, it looks like we're not going to have Dina Contella. So we'll move on to the next part of our little documentary here about the International Space Station. What the space station astronauts and cosmonauts will be doing later this year was to have been described by Dina Contella, the lead flight director at the Johnson Space Center. So we're being briefed on the current status and future plans for the space station. Tara Rutley was the next invited to address the invited journalists. She is the Associate Program Scientist for the International Space Station. Now that the construction phase of the space station is over, science activities are now in full swing. It was not surprising that she had lots to tell us.
I'm excited to talk the research. To me, it's always one of the coolest things happening on station. And I've seen as we transition into the next decade of utilization, our teams internally have been really busy managing and processing the research that's coming and going. And I've seen the crew on orbit is just as busy implementing it. So we're looking ahead to meeting the full research objectives that were created when Space Station was first envisioned. And I think everyone, as I'm hearing from scientists to students, are anxiously anticipating what's to come now in the next decade of Space Station research in relation to this unique orbiting laboratory, which is what it is. So to date on station, there have been nearly 1,300 investigations performed through Expedition 30. This represents over 1,300 scientists worldwide in 65 countries globally. Through the remainder of this year, there will be over 200 investigations performed in the areas of human research, biology and biotech, earth and space sciences, physical science, technology development, and education. Each of these investigations will provide knowledge that advances the human exploration of space, improves our daily life on Earth, and contributes to our own fundamental knowledge through new discoveries. No laboratory on the planet allows scientists to perform sustained, repeatable measurements of their data while controlling for gravity, and no unmanned orbiting vehicle can provide the combination of automated and real-time human-tended constant observation of the Earth's ecosystems and natural disaster events. No laboratory on the planet has inspired the scientific creativity in over 4 million students in the U.S. alone. Although hundreds of investigations will be performed on Space Station during Expeditions 32 and 33, today I only have time to tell you just about a few of those and their relevance in the research program's portfolio. So first I'll tell you about one of the new research facilities headed to Space Station on HTV-3 this summer, and that's of primary importance to our Japanese partners, and that's the aquatic habitat. The aquatic habitat will house small freshwater fish, such as madaka and zebrafish, and it'll allow scientists to watch them grow over generations on Space Station and understand the physiological changes that happen in these small model vertebrates. The aquatic habitat has two transparent aquariums designed for the microgravity environment. It consists of environmental control systems and CCD cameras for imaging, including infrared. The first investigation in the aquatic habitat is actually planned for next year, and a look at changes in skeletal composition of fish grown in a microgravity environment. Because we know that bone density is lost in astronauts at a rate of about 2% per month on orbit, studies like these are critical to keep our astronauts healthy. And the data collected from investigations like this will also contribute to better understandings of debilitating skeletal muscles skeletal conditions that we see here on Earth, such as osteoporosis, which currently affects an estimated 75 million people in Japan, Europe, and America. The space station also offers unique opportunities for observing the Earth, both from terms of orbital characteristics and human and infrastructure support. A new investigation called the ISS SERVIR Environmental Research and Visualization System, or ISER for short, will arrive at the space station on HTV-3, and it'll serve as a pathfinder to increase Earth imaging capabilities that could be used to support disaster assessment, humanitarian assistance, and environmental management. This investigation is part of the SERVIR program, which is a joint partnership between NASA and the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, that allows people in developing regions to access data about the Earth for a variety of purposes. The iServe is a fully automated Earth imaging instrument that will be mounted Earth-facing in the optical quality window within the wharf in the Destiny lab. And to give you an example of the types of images you can get from the space station, this is a picture of Hurricane Isabel taken by astronaut Ed Liu from the space station as it headed for the U.S. East Coast. And images like these have been used by global organizations such as the National Hurricane Center to characterize storm dynamics and plan for appropriate response. So this is just one more example of how the space station partnership is working to maximize the benefits of the vehicle as an Earth observation platform. Along the physical sciences front, the new Advanced Colloids Experiment 1 that will begin this fall is the first in a series of complex fluid investigations that will explore how colloids behave in microgravity under using the on-orbit light microscope. Because colloids are the basis for many of the materials we use here on Earth, understanding their behavior under different conditions could tell us how to improve many of the products that we use, such as household cleaners, foods, and medicine, as well as how to engineer brand new ones. It's also important in the design of spacecraft materials, improvements in propellant and enabling us to have long-term stowage of goods and products on longer missions as we go below low Earth orbit. On Earth, it's tough to study colloidal behavior because under the force of gravity, particles tend to settle within their fluid. So scientists don't get a true representation of the particle-particle interaction. And Removing gravity allows us to watch the natural interaction of colloidal systems as they remain suspended over an infinite amount of time in a microgravity environment. So you get a true visual of what their behavior is like without the gravity masking their behavior. So you're looking at an image of Dan Burbank now, currently on orbit, and he's actually been performing the preliminary experiments on the light microscopy module. He's looking at different samples under different conditions to ensure the microscope is ready for the ACE-1 investigation this fall. The space station is also the ideal platform to advance space technology, and I'll discuss two of these demonstrations today. The first of these is the Robotic Refueling Mission, or RRM, which is a joint NASA and Canadian Space Agency effort. And the purpose of the RRM is to operationally check out and test a mock-up satellite for potential refueling on orbit. The first operations actually started a few weeks ago, and the point is to robotically service and refuel satellites in space. It's something that can't be done right now. The RRM hardware is located on the ELC position of the External Space Station truss. And again, it's a satellite mock-up about the size of a washing machine that provides activity boards and tools to practice these servicing tasks. Operations are actually remotely controlled at NASA and CSA's control center, and the first fuel servicing is planned to occur during Expeditions 32 and 33. And we begin here with Dexter using the safety cap tool to remove the safety cap from a fill and drain valve and allows access for refueling. On real satellites, the safety cap helps prevent hazardous fuel from leaking while a spacecraft is still on the ground. And now the safety cap tool is going to be, and the cap is going to be stowed away, and we'll move on to the actual fuel servicing task. Dexter here switches to the nozzle refueling, the nozzle tool with the robotic fueling holes, with the hose to transfer the liquid ethanol fuel through the fill and drain valve in a closed loop. So RRM carries about 1.7 liters of ethanol fuel for this demonstration, and there's a demonstration of the transfer. And after the fuel transfer, the fitting is left behind, which on a real satellite refueling mission would give easy access to the fuel valve on a return visit. RRM will remain on the space station for 2 years and will lay the foundation for potential fuel servicing missions in space. The second investigation making use of space station as a test bed for advancing space technology is the Space Communications and Navigation Test Bed Investigation, or SCAN Test Bed. SCAN Test Bed will be the first software-defined radios that will be sent to station that will allow engineers to actually change the software on these devices even after they've launched. So, for example, ground controllers will be able to reprogram these radios to change the type of data that needs to be transferred depending on the experiment, depending on the situation. And this includes things, data such as video, telemetry, and voice, just to name a few. The SCAN testbed will launch to the station on HTV-3 this summer, and the robotic arms will move it to its permanent location on the external truss. SCAN will allow researchers to conduct a suite of experiments over the next 5 years that will enable the advancement of a new generation of space communication. Now, the antenna you see that's about to gimbal will allow communications between NASA's relay satellites and ground station around the U.S., so we're really looking forward to seeing what SCAN testbed can do for us for communications and data transfer. And we're excited about all of these investigations that are going to be implemented in 32-33. So you can see from the breadth of these experiments that station is really realizing its potential across all the disciplines. We're excited to get to work with the crew to start these investigations and the other hundreds of others planned for the remainder of this year. And thank you very much.
That was Tara Rutley, the Associate Program Scientist for the International Space Station. She was speaking last month at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. And it looks like we're going to have to declare Dina Contella missing in action. Hopefully we'll be able to find her for our fifth program in this five-part series about the International Space Station here on Sullen FM. Now, I spent April of 2010 at the Kennedy Space Center reporting for the Space Show on the rundown of the Space Shuttle program. While there, I attended many media briefings like the one we're listening to tonight. One thing I thought might interest Space Show listeners was how cargo and scientific experiments would be delivered to the space station in the absence of the heavy lift capability of the Space Shuttle. I put that question to Mark Uran. He is NASA's Assistant Associate Administrator in charge of the International Space Station. Andrew Rennie from Southern FM in Melbourne, Australia. Question to Mark, please. Without the shuttle, Will the European Space Agency's ATV and Japan's HTV be sufficient to loft all the experiments to ISS? And a follow-up question, and what about returning materials from the space station? Will you have enough capacity for the completed science?
Yeah, no, those are excellent questions. First, you probably heard the analogy that the shuttle is like a 16-wheeler. It's much more capacity than we would ever need to operate and maintain the space station, conduct the research program over the next decade. So we have this combination of our partner vehicles as well as the contracts that we put in place here in the United States for commercial vehicles that will be providing cargo, resupply, and return services to us over the next decade. Those are going to be demonstrated. The demonstrations begin next year, and over the 2011-2012 period, we'll see these commercial capabilities come on orbit. If those capabilities were delayed, the resources available from our partners are sufficient to operate and maintain the spacecraft and to carry on our mission requirements at NASA. But we would delay a full-up utilization of the station if those cargo resupply services were delayed. But we're confident that within the next 1 to 2 years, we're going to begin seeing those demonstrations. And one of those resupply contractors has a return service.
2 years later, that very same question is still being asked.
Thank you. And the last question from here is, it's been 8 months since the last shuttle delivery. How is it going without shuttles to bring up and bring down? I'm just wondering the status in orbit without the coming and going of the big shuttles as they once did.
Well, you know, we'd reached a point. Well, first of all, I miss my shuttle friends. Shuttle was an amazing vehicle, and personally, it was fascinating to watch and to try to utilize. But we finished assembly of ISS, and we no longer required a vehicle of that capacity to just service the ISS. And so, from that respect, we're not missing the shuttle. Now, there were things that the shuttle was uniquely able to do that we don't get with smaller vehicles, and that's okay because that's where we are in the life cycle of the ISS, and really it's time for us to focus not on big missions that we end up racing through the work to do a major mod to the ISS, but rather now's the time to have the logistics vehicles show up. Logistics vehicles that can stay a while the crew, while they're doing their other jobs, can empty it out as necessary. Eventually, do the external offload and reload, and then depart in a manner that allows us to continue the other things we're doing before the vehicle arrives. So, in some respects, these other vehicles that service ISS are more adapt to how we operate today as opposed to the assembly phase. So while the ISS, while the shuttle was a very, very capable vehicle, it would have been overkill to maintain the ISS long term with that vehicle. Now, the piece that we as a country are working on and should, of course, is the alternate means for rotating a crew, which we do miss without a shuttle, and we are, of course, as you know, working towards creating a capability, an alternate capability, so we have a backup way to get to ISS with crew.
And Tara, did you want to address research?
Yeah, so with regard to payload capabilities of the vehicles that we're using now versus shuttle, we've actually had even more room than we've ever had on shuttle in terms of volume for payloads, up and down mass, or at least up mass. And so we've been able to implement our research complement, and we're also looking forward to SpaceX. Even SpaceX Demo has an investigation on it, and that's the NanoRacks investigation. So with the SpaceX complement coming up, we will have up and down mass, and so we're looking forward to that capability to bring our samples home. And so we've had good progress so far without shuttle, at least with regard to research. And so we're again looking forward to SpaceX and Orbital coming online as well.
And then I'll just jump on the bandwagon a little and point out that, you know, I think that there's folks might think that things have gotten kind of less busy now on space station, but it's incredibly busy. First of all, the research that Tara mentioned, this really takes over a huge amount of the crew's day. It's really exciting to watch the crew. They're talking to scientists around the world, and they're doing some incredible, incredible research. Additionally, we have all these vehicles coming and going, and it's really busy. It seems like the assembly phase. So I don't want folks to think that things have just slowed down on space station. It's really not the case.
That was Mike Saffredini and Tara Rutley on how the space station program is coping without the cargo lift capabilities of the space shuttle. Well, this is program 3 in a 5-part series about the International Space Station. More after these messages.
I'm Peter Hitchener. More than 288,000 Australians right now have hearing and sight impairments. Imagine if you could not see and also not hear. Able Australia is helping many Australians living with deaf blindness. You can help too. Visit ableaustralia.org.au. That's ableaustralia.org.au or call 1300 225 369. 1300 225 369.
Lee Cummins, a.k.a. Madam Media, presents Megabyte Mondays, the radio program showcasing information for small to medium businesses on marketing, business, internet strategies and some techie tips. Join Lee Cummins Mondays 10 till 11 on 88.3 Southern FM.
You're listening to The Space Show. During the Space Station Mir program, the Russians built up considerable experience in long-duration spaceflight. Even so, the longest spaceflight ever was 438 days, far short of the time required for a human flight to Mars. Currently, astronauts spend a tour of duty of 6 months on the space station. The question of long-duration spaceflights came up at this media conference we're at the Johnson Space Center. Here's what they had to say.
Jim Ober for NBC. Good morning, and thank you for sharing the time. You mentioned this comm delay issue, and the question is really for Mike. There's talk about using the ISS as the location for an analog mission, a reflight of the Russian Mars 500 long-duration mission. Are we really looking toward emissions in the next couple of years that could last people, could people in orbit for 2 years or longer? Is that sort of thing being discussed? And can you just assess, is that scientifically or medically feasible?
Well, clearly, in order to be able to explore beyond low Earth orbit, we're going to have to stay in orbit a little longer than 6 months. And so one of the things we have been talking about for some time, in fact, since the advent of a low Earth orbiting platform, is its benefit for human research. And part of that, of course, is determining how long the human system can survive in a microgravity environment. And can it survive a microgravity environment for an extended period of time and then land on a foreign planet and expect the human to be able to do his or her tasks while they're there, and then return home, again experience the same microgravity environment for an extended period of time. So that's a long-winded way of saying yes, we're considering that. We're talking to our partners about that. In fact, it was a bit of a discussion during our heads of agency in Quebec about some of our offline discussions were about what steps do we need to take to put ourselves in a position to be able to extend the crew's time on orbit as part of the human research study on the human system's ability to withstand long-duration spaceflight. So, absolutely, that's part of what we're looking at. And what Dina will tell you about here in just a second is really the beginning of a set of simulations that were to also include extension of the crew on orbit. But as you said, that's not an activity that's going to occur tomorrow. We're taking steps, and we will evolve to this point over a number of years so that we can get all the data we need before the end of the ISS lifetime.
Okay, and then so related just specifically to these particular experiments, you know, we talked about instant messaging, and this is like a chat feature and that sort of thing. So you can imagine if we had Capcom or flight director calling up to the crew and there was a significant delay, this would be in some future mission, that you'd sort of wonder, well, did they hear me? I have something else I want to add, and it's more difficult to have a conversation with a comm delay. So potentially we're looking at something that would be more akin to email or a chat feature. So we're talking about doing that on this increment. And additionally, you know, the crew, if they're going to go land on some foreign planet or go out into deep space, you know, onto some other mission, you could conceive of it being difficult for them to have a conversation with the ground if some piece of equipment breaks. So we would want to make sure that we would have all kinds of contingencies sort of in place in our procedures. Well, if you can't find this cable, use this one. Or if you have trouble with this wire, then this is our recommendation. So what we're going to do is put some slightly more autonomous type procedures and stowage information and that sort of thing on board for the crew so they would rely on the ground less on this particular experiment on Expedition 3233. So that's kind of a lead-in, and we're really just sort of laying the groundwork and getting some of these tools ready, and we're working our way up to an eventual type of comm delay kind of experiment, but that would be a few increments in the future.
Three, a space station manager speaking at a media briefing at the Johnson Space Center. Several weeks ago, NASA Administrator Charlie Bolton gave evidence before a 2012 budget hearing of the United States Congress. Congressman Fattah asked Bolton, who has piloted the space shuttle four times, about the neurological effects of long-duration spaceflight. During the interchange between Fattah and Bolton, the question of the longest human spaceflight came up. Well, the longest duration human flight was by Russian cosmonaut Valery Polyakov. This doctor began living aboard the Mir space station in 1994 January and stayed there for 438 days. During two missions, he accumulated a total of 678 days in space. His first mission began in 1998 August and saw him living aboard the Salyut 7 space station for almost 8 months. Another Russian cosmonaut clocked up 478 days in orbit over three space flights. That was Sergei Avdeyev. During five space flights, Anatoly Solovyov flew for 651 days. His countryman, Alexander Kaleri, has clocked up 769 days in orbit during five missions. The name Sergei Krikalev comes up because he flew with Charlie Bolden on STS-60, an 8-day space shuttle mission. However, over his career, he has made both short and long duration flights. This included 4 months aboard the International Space Station and nearly a year on the Russian space station Mir. He is the all-time champion for space flight. During six flights, he has accumulated 803 days in space. Well, here's the exchange that happened between Congressman Fattah and NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden.
I saw the study, a little brief article about the health impact with regard to the brain, with regard to astronauts, Aleph. Would you want to talk a little
bit about that? Yes, sir. The impact that we have recently discovered, and we have consulted with our Russian partners because they have a lot more experience.
Who is the person who's been out longer? Probably a Russian?
Nope.
No? How many days would that
be? I will find out for you, but we have a couple of astronauts who are the longest serving person in space today is my old crew member, Sergei Konstantinovich Krikalev, without a doubt. Sergei has spent about 2 years in space.
How's he doing today?
He's doing well, but, you know, I haven't talked to Sergei to ask him what his latest MRI showed about his optic nerve or whether he suffers from increased intraocular pressure. When Sergei and I flew together in 1994, we didn't even know what increased intraocular pressure is. And this is a recent discovery. We have had some of our researchers who have known about it, but in the case of medical science researchers, they don't like to talk about things until they have enough ends.
Are we asking the Russians if we...
Yes, we are. And the Russians initially said, no, we don't know what you're talking about. We haven't seen it, but in hindsight, they went back and said, you know, we have seen that.
And are we having our doctors examine?
We collaborate. We collaborate with them. And what we're talking about is increased pressure behind the eye that has done... If you want to talk about things that it has done. It causes some flattening in the area of the retina that impacts vision, decreases vision in some, not all. We are noticing that it's increased pressure on the optic nerve. We're concerned there because it could result in blindness if it got to the point that it was extreme. We don't see that yet. When talking to my chief medical officer, Dr. Rich Williams, he is not to the point yet where he thinks this has a long-term impact on long-duration human exploration. Yeah, one of the things that people need to understand, these are microgravity phenomena. One of the reasons we might go to the surface of the moon quicker than we thought is to put people there for an extended period of time, 30 days or something, to see if we see the same thing that we're seeing in the space station. Station is zero G. The lunar surface is a sixth of Earth's gravity. Mars has gravity. So these problems may not even materialize themselves in an astronaut that's resident on another planet or on a moon or something.
And now you're talking about a subject that I'm quite impressed with the work of NASA related to this. And we had some briefings earlier this week, in fact, on the neuroscience work and studies that NASA has been doing. And one of the things, Mr. Chairman, they noticed is not only this issue around the optics, but also in terms of in the human brain, these Alzheimer's-like effects that happen for astronauts while they're in space and disappear when they return. And NASA has been doing a lot of work in this regard, and along with some of the international partners, I understand there's been some surgical research done in terms of neuroscience surgery related tests that have been done on the space station. This is an area that they've done a tremendous amount of work over a number of years, and is very, very important. So I want to commend you. Yeah. Now, we've had personal conversations about this, and the chairman and I collaborated around getting OSTP to launch a working group, bringing together agencies that are doing work in brain research. But I'm quite impressed with the work that NASA is doing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for bringing this up.
Congressman, I appreciate that. If I may just make one statement, because we've talked a lot about value. I can't put a dollar value on the research on the International Space Station. The fact that we now know much more than we ever knew about osteoporosis, which affects women and men, by the way, the fact that we now have discovered this problem with increased interocular pressure, I don't have a way to put a dollar value on that. So if you ask me, is $100 billion of investment in the International Space Station worth it? You bet. If I could put a dollar value on the medical returns here on Earth, I tell people, I go home every day. I feel great because I've made life better for somebody on this Earth. And I apologize for being so passionate about this, but I would hate to see the nation become short-sighted with reference to the money that we spend on space exploration. You cannot place a value on the benefits that come from the International Space Station. We have a book that's called Benefits from the International Space Station, and it's only biomedical benefits from the last few years. You can't put a price tag on anything that's in that book. But I would bet, if you could, we're talking about trillions of dollars. So I am concerned in these tight fiscal times that the nation lose its way, and those of us, you on this committee and others, who have to make hard decisions, decide that we're going to not invest in human exploration because we'll do it later.
Charlie Bolden, NASA's administrator, in discussion with Congressman Fattah several weeks ago. Now, let's go back to that science briefing in Houston. Tara Rutley, as associate program scientist, was asked about the longest-running research on the International Space Station.
The question is, what is the longest-running research project on the ISS? And this comes from Karen Lopez at DataCheck.
Oh, wow. Okay. Longest-running research. Probably there are two that come to mind. There are actually three. There's a repository where there's continuous collection of bodily samples from the crew that the crew offers to return home, and it's a repository of physiological specimens, blood, urine, and that goes here to JSC, and it gets stowed away for future use on upcoming investigations that we haven't even thought about yet. And so that's constantly going. Another one would be the nutrition study, where we're constantly analyzing, and the crew are constantly logging what they're eating, and then we do a number of different studies and things that are related to what they eat. So we look at bone and muscle changes, changes in their vitamin status. And so that one seems to be ongoing. The third I can think of is the journals study. It's a behavioral study that's ongoing. And as you can imagine, over the last 10 years of space station, through the assembly phase, and as we change from the number of crew on board at any one time, and just the culture changes and the time changes over the time that we've seen a space station, the journal entries and the behavioral responses of the crew are important. And so those are being monitored and considered and applied to potential future use for human exploration beyond low Earth orbit. So those, I think, are the three continuous. There's also a sleep study that's been ongoing for a while. Most of the continuous investigations that have been up on station for a while are human research based, because we need so many humans involved in data collection. You need a solid sample size, and that takes time over a period of several years in some cases. So we see those ongoing, and they are also critical as things just change on orbit. The culture changes, the environment changes, the personality types changes, the crew complement size changes, and then we also need those human subject counts.
On this evening's space show, we have been looking at the current status of the International Space Station and some of the scientific research being done there. And this is Program 3 in a series of 5 about the space station. Next week, we look at the plans for commercial companies to bring cargo and astronauts to the station. And the series has been researched, written and produced and presented by Andrew Rennie for Southern FM on Melbourne's Space Show. Now, earlier in this program, we made mention of Russian cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev. During 6 space flights, he has been in space longer than any other human. 803 days, 9 hours and 39 minutes. Cuban songwriter and singer Silvio Rodriguez dedicated a song to him after Sergei became known as the last Soviet citizen. This was because the Soviet Union was broken up during one of its long-duration missions aboard the Mir space station. The song is called Cassiopeia, after the constellation of that name. It is sung in Spanish.
Esperar, esperar. Hoy llevo el doble dando coordenadas, pero nadie contesta mi llamada. ¿Qué puede haber pasado a mi señal? ¿Será
Cuban Silvio Rodriguez with a concert performance of his song Cassiopeia, written in honor of Sergio Krikalev. The studio version can be found on his 1993 album Rodriguez. Along with American astronaut Robert Cabana, Sergio was the first to go aboard the International Space Station in 1998 December.